From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Our hope is that the situation will get better and Iraq will return to the way it was, and that everyone can go back to their homes and their jobs. But this is just hope.
Today, Iraqi refugees. There are 2 million displaced inside Iraq and almost 2 million outside Iraq. We'll bring you a report on refugees in Syria. Then we'll speak with journalist Nir Rosen and talk about refugees in Jordan, Lebanon, and other places. He's just back from Beirut. Then two teenagers walk from San Francisco to Washington, D.C. for peace. We catch up with them in Indianapolis. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Carl Levin, is calling for the ouster of Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and his cabinet. Levin said, quote, "I hope the parliament will vote the Maliki government out of office and will have the wisdom to replace it with a less sectarian and more unifying prime minister and government." Levin also accused the government of Iraq of being non-functional. His comments came after a three-day trip to Iraq and Jordan. The Washington Post reports Levin's statement marks the most forceful call for leadership change in Iraq from a U.S. elected official. Meanwhile, the White House has announced General David Petraeus, the top commander in Iraq, and Ambassador Ryan Crocker will testify before Congress during the second week of September. It appears likely their testimony will occur on September 11th, the sixth anniversary of the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon. Thousands of protesters have gathered near Ottawa to protest a meeting of President Bush, Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, and Mexican President Felipe Calderon. On Monday, riot police used tear gas and pepper spray to block protesters from approaching the site of the summit. The North American leaders are meeting to discuss expanding NAFTA by agreeing to the so-called Security and Prosperity Partnership. The SPP is a White House-led initiative consisting of secretive series of agreements between the three countries on issues including trade, border security, and patent protections. Mexican President Felipe Calderon is cutting short his trip to Canada to return home because of Hurricane Dean, the Category 5 storm that made landfall on Mexico's Yucatan coast this morning. Winds were recorded as high as 165 miles per hour. Forecasters predict the hurricane could inflict catastrophic damage along Mexico's coast. Over 100,000 people have been evacuated from the region. The hurricane has killed at least 12 people in the Caribbean so far. In news from the Middle East, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in Gaza are enduring a fifth day of power blackouts. The power outages began after the European Union suspended its funding of Gaza's main electricity plant. Gaza has been under a siege since June, when Hamas seized full control of the area. The United States, Israel, and other countries have attempted to completely isolate Gaza in an effort to turn the population against the democratically elected Hamas leadership. Aid agencies are warning if Gaza didn't receive more fuel by Thursday, the Strip's main sewage and water treatment plant would be forced to shut down. The White House is continuing to refuse to turn over subpoenaed information about the Bush administration's warrantless domestic surveillance program. Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Senator Patrick Leahy has threatened to hold top members of the Bush administration in contempt if they continue to refuse to turn over the information. After the White House missed Monday's deadline, Leahy said, quote, "We should not have to legislate in the dark when the administration hides behind a fictitious veil of secrecy." The Army has dismissed two of the most serious charges against the only military officer facing trial for abusing detainees at Abu Ghraib. The announcement came just before the start of court-martial proceedings against Army Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Jordan. 8 out of the 12 original charges against the Army officer have been dismissed since he was first charged. The latest move reduces Jordan's potential sentence almost by half to a maximum of 8.5 years. Attorneys for the Cuban Five argued Monday before a federal appeals court that jailed men deserve another trial. The men were arrested in 1998 and convicted of spying for the Cuban government 3 years later. They maintain they were sent to the United States to monitor violent exile groups calling for the overthrow of Fidel Castro. In August 2005, A three-judge panel of the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta tossed the verdict, saying the five didn't receive a fair trial because of anti-Castro bias in Miami. But the convictions were reinstated exactly a year later by the full 11th Circuit. This is Andres Gomez from the group Alianza Martiana.
Five Cubans were falsely accused by the United States government of being in the United States to spy on the government of the United States. The government of the United States knows that these five men were in the United States, specifically Miami, to infiltrate extreme right-wing Cuban terrorist organizations operating out of Miami, which for 40 years have perpetrated acts of terrorism on the Cuban people and against others here in the United States who have been against their objectives and their methods.
Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark spoke on behalf of the Cuban five.
I think the thing that needs to be recognized, however, is that if you want to stop terrorism, you don't persecute people who are engaged in trying to prevent terrorism.
In other news on Cuba, Democratic presidential candidate Senator Barack Obama has proposed easing restrictions for Cuban Americans who want to visit the island or send money home. In an opinion column published in the Miami Herald, Obama wrote, quote, I will grant Cuban Americans unrestricted rights to visit family and send remittances to the island. One of Obama's opponents, Connecticut Senator Christopher Dodd, is co-sponsoring an even broader bill that would allow any American citizen to visit Cuba. The former news chief of CNN is defending his decision to seek the Pentagon's approval of prospective CNN news analysts during the lead-up to the Iraq War. Eason Jordan's comments have come under renewed scrutiny after being featured in Norman Solomon's film, War Made Easy.
Well, I think it's important to have experts explain the war and to describe the military hardware, describe the tactics, talk about the strategy behind the conflict. I went to the Pentagon myself several times before the war started, met with important people there and said, for instance, at CNN, here are the generals we're thinking of retaining to advise us on the air and off about the war, and we got a big thumbs up on all of them. That was important.
Eason Jordan, who now runs the Iraq Slogger website, defended his actions last week. He said, quote, employers routinely vet prospective employees with their previous employers. In these cases, we vetted retired generals to ensure they were experts in specific military and geographic areas. The generals were not vetted for political views. The star football quarterback Michael Vick has reportedly agreed to plead guilty to federal dogfighting charges and could face over a year in jail. Last month, Vick and three co-defendants were charged with operating an illegal dogfighting and betting ring based in southeastern Virginia. Two of his co-defendants said Vick participated in the killing of at least eight dogs, some by hanging and drowning. In April, authorities raided Vick's property and found at least 60 pit bulls and paraphernalia commonly associated with dogfighting. Some of the animals reportedly had deep wounds and cuts consistent with fighting. Authorities later reportedly found up to 30 dog corpses buried on the property. The People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals has begun offering $5,000 rewards for tips leading to the conviction of those involved in dogfighting. Meanwhile, former world heavyweight boxing champ Layman Brewster has joined PETA's campaign against dogfighting.
I'm heavyweight boxing champion Relentless Layman Brewster for PETA. I usually let my fists do the talking for me, but I always speak up for the animals. Dogfighting is a cruel and deadly activity in which dogs are forced to tear each other apart. I choose to fight every time I step into the ring, but animals aren't given that choice. For more information, please visit helpinganimals.com.
In Utah, officials have indefinitely suspended efforts to rescue six coal miners trapped inside the Crandall Canyon. The decision was announced after a group of mining experts concluded the area where the men were trapped was structurally unstable and would probably collapse again. Last week, three men died during the rescue effort, but family members of the relatives accused authorities of giving up. This is Sunny Olson, a spokesperson for the family members of the six trapped coal miners.
Our families have concluded that Bob Murray, Richard Stickler, and Rob Moore have given up on the miners. We feel that Bob Murray has abandoned us. Mr. Murray has not been present since the tragic accident on Thursday night. We beg the communities in Carbon and Emery County, the state, and our nation for your support in demanding that this above ground method of rescue can be attempted. The rescue capsule is our family's last and only hope.
In Minnesota, divers have recovered the remains of the 13th and last known victim from the highway bridge collapse 3 weeks ago. Meanwhile, Star Tribune reports that state officials considered condemning the bridge last year because of the possibility it could collapse. Plans to reinforce the bridge were well underway when the project came to a halt in January amidst concerns about safety and cost. And the New York Times reports the Bush administration has adopted new standards that would make it much more difficult for New York, California, and other states to extend the Children's Health Insurance Program to children in middle-income families. Some state officials said yesterday it could cripple their efforts to cover more children and would impose standards that could not be met. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Over 4 years of brutal warfare in Iraq has spawned a refugee crisis of staggering proportions. 2 million Iraqis have been forced to leave their country and are now scattered across Syria, Jordan, Egypt, Iran, Lebanon, and Turkey. Another 1.9 million Iraqis have been forced to flee their homes and join the growing ranks of the internally displaced. Since 2003, the United States has accepted only 701 Iraqi refugees. In a moment, we'll be joined by journalist Nir Rosen. He's just returned from Beirut. But first, we'll turn to a segment on Iraqi refugee crisis with a short report from an Iraqi family displaced in Damascus, Syria. There are an estimated 1.2 million Iraqi refugees in Syria. This report was filed from Damascus by Democracy Now! Correspondent Jen Utes.
Mohammed is celebrating his 14th birthday. His family is among the 1.4 million Iraqi refugees currently estimated to be living in Syria. The electricity went out in the middle of the party, as it often has over the course of the last year and a half that they've been in exile. But life goes on. With the war entering its fifth year and over 4 million people displaced, those who wonder how an American journalist visiting a family of Iraqi refugees would be treated might be surprised. Mohammed's family of five lives in Daf al-Shouk, a poor neighborhood of Damascus, where they pay $250 per month for this one-bedroom apartment. Upon my arrival, Mohammed's mother, Haifa, immediately began preparing a large meal.
This is our custom. When a guest comes to our house, we give them the best we have, no matter what situation we're living in.
After our meal, the family sang me a traditional song from their region. Originally from Basra, Haifa is Shiite and her husband Omar is Sunni.
When I went to ask her hand in marriage, her parents didn't ask me what sect I was from. Our neighborhood was middle class with nice houses and gardens. One of my neighbors was Christian, another was Armenian and Sunni and Shiite. We shared everything. We ate together. We celebrated together. We even shared all religious holidays together.
Things changed dramatically after the war, they say, and Omar bought a Kalashnikov to protect his family. However, they decided to leave when Haifa found a warning from the local Shiite militia on her front door, insisting they leave their home or the entire family would be killed.
My husband was at work, and I opened the front door, and I saw this letter. So I kept the kids home from school. I started to call my neighbors. They tried to calm me down, and then they took me to the police station. The police read the letter, and they laughed and said, "We can't do anything for you."
At the time, militia groups were taking over vacated homes, so Omar paid an armed guard $250 a month to keep an eye on their house. On the day of my visit, Haifa had just paid $350 to enroll her two eldest children in private school for 1 year, because public schools, burdened by the growing number of refugees, are full.
We appreciate that the Syrian government and its people have been so generous to the huge number of Iraqis.
However, Iraqi refugees are forbidden from working in Syria, and the family's savings are running out. Plus, they tell me that life in exile is emotionally crippling, and they have no hope they'll go home anytime soon.
Our hope is that the situation will get better and Iraq will return to the way it was, and that everyone can go back to their homes and their jobs. But this is just hope. We see this as something impossible. And now we are just hoping to move to any country just to live our life.
We continued our conversation, and as I was wrapping up the interview, Omar wanted to ask me a question.
What's happening in Iraq is because of your president. He's the main reason. Most of the Iraqis have been forced to leave their homes and their families. They have had family members kidnapped or killed. There is no house in Iraq that doesn't have a problem like this. There must be a solution for Iraqi people. Why don't they find a solution?
After all they had shared with me, I wanted to give something back, but I had nothing to say. From Damascus, Syria, this is Jen Yutz for Democracy Now!
Nir Rosen is an independent journalist and the author of In the Belly of the Green Bird, The Triumph of the Martyrs in Iraq. He's fellow at the New America Foundation, has reported extensively from Iraq since the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. Earlier this year, Nir Rosen wrote a piece, a cover story for the New York Times Sunday Magazine called The Flight from Iraq. He estimated up to 50,000 Iraqis were leaving their homes each month. Nir Rosen joins us now from our Firehouse studio here in New York, just returned from Beirut on Sunday night. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you talk further about the refugee crisis? Again, lay out the numbers that we're talking about inside Iraq and outside.
Well, outside Iraq, we're approaching 3 million refugees who've left since 2003. There were, of course, refugees who left before then, due to Saddam and other factors. Inside, I think you have a similar number of internally displaced Iraqis fleeing their homes in mixed areas and going to more homogeneous areas. Sunnis from Basra heading to Sunni neighborhoods of Baghdad or all the way up to Kurdistan. Shias from Diyala province going to safer areas for Shias. Kurds from Mosul going up to Kurdistan as well. And a family like the one we just saw on the show is never going to go back to their home again, actually, it seems.
Why?
Iraq has been changed irrevocably, I think. I don't think Iraq, you can even say it exists anymore. There's been a very effective, systematic ethnic cleansing of Sunnis from Baghdad, of Shias from areas that are now mostly Shia. But Sunnis especially have been a target, as have mixed families. Like the one we just saw, with a name like Omar, he's distinctively Sunni, it's a very Sunni name. You can be executed for having the name Omar alone. And Baghdad is now firmly in the hands of sectarian Shiite militias, and they're never going to let it go.
What do you think of Senator Levin calling for Maliki and the whole government to disband?
Well, it's stupid for several reasons. First of all, the Iraqi government doesn't matter. It has no power, and it doesn't matter who you put in there. He's not going to have any power. Baghdad doesn't really matter, except for Baghdad. Baghdad used to be the most important city in Iraq, and whoever controlled Baghdad controlled Iraq. These days, you have a collection of city-states, Mosul, Basra, Baghdad, Kirkuk, Erbil, Sulaymaniyah. Each one is virtually independent, and they have their own warlords and their own militias. And what happens in Baghdad makes no difference. So that's the first point. Second of all, who can he put in instead? What does he think he's going to put in, Alawi or some secular candidate? There was a democratic election, and the majority of Iraqis selected the sectarian Shiite group Dawah, Supreme Council of Islamic Revolution, the Sadr movement. These are the movements that are popular among the majority of Shias, who are the majority of Iraq. So it doesn't matter who you put in there. And people in the Greens that have never had any power, Americans, whether in the government or journalists, have been focused on the Green Zone from the beginning of the war. And it's never really mattered. It's been who has power on the street, various different militias, depending on where you are, Shia, Sunni, tribal, religious, criminal. So it just reflects the same misunderstanding of Iraqi politics. The government doesn't do anything. It doesn't provide any services, whether security, electricity, health, or otherwise. Various militias control various ministries, and they use it as their fiefdoms. Ministries attack other ministries.
Which is the most powerful militia?
Well, the various Shia ones, such as the Mahdi army, the Badr Corps, the police, the Iraqi police, the Iraqi army. Of course, the American army is also another militia, and it's a very powerful militia in Iraq, although maybe not the most powerful. But the Mahdi army basically controls the police and the Iraqi army. Of course, in the north, the police are more in the hands of various Kurdish militias, and the army is in the hands of Kurdish militias. So it sort of depends where you are.
We're going to break. When we come back, we are going to talk more about the refugees throughout the Middle East. There are not many here in this country. We're talking to Nir Rosen, independent journalist, author of In the Belly of the Green Bird, The Triumph of the Martyrs in Iraq. Stay with us. Only Iraqi metal group. It resides in Damascus, Syria. The name of the song is Massacre. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM, college and community radio stations, on public access TV stations and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish for any radio station to take at democracynow.org. They're also there in transcript form. We're talking to Nir Rosen, independent journalist, author of In the Belly of the Green Bird, The Triumph of the Martyrs in Iraq, a fellow at the New America Foundation, has reported extensively from Iraq since the U.S.-led invasion in 2003, most recently has just returned from Beirut, actually on Sunday night, and has particularly focused on refugees. His piece in the New York Times was called The Flight from Iraq. Talk about why people go to different countries, why Iraqis go in this. You're saying up to 3 million Iraqis out of a population of, what, some 27 million?
26, 27 originally, yeah. Nobody knows for sure.
More than, so close to 10%.
Yes, and of course, up to a million have died.
And more than 10%.
Since the occupation began. Well, there are various factors for why they choose different countries. Access is one of them. Syria is the most open and generous of all the countries in the region. And they basically take anybody who comes in. And they, for a long time, they were giving them free health care, and they still provide free education. Although they've been, they're being overburdened as well, because the Syrian government subsidizes things such as bread. So every loaf of bread an Iraqi buys is actually being paid for in part by the Syrian government. As a result, they're finding it more and more difficult to bear the cost. The Jordanians basically closed their borders by the end of 2005, in part because they were being overburdened. And they also have demographic issues to worry about. Half of the small Jordanian population are Palestinian, and now you've introduced another million Iraqis. And this is a very fragile regime in the first place, the Jordanian dictatorship.
What does each country gain by letting in Iraqi refugees?
Well, Jordan took in initially many of the wealthy ones, as did Egypt. And so they certainly gained a great deal of money and investment. And they required for residency a certain amount of money in the bank. But Jordan was a less friendly environment for Shias. Syria, again, is the most friendly environment for really any Iraqi. Shias, Sunnis, Christians, each find welcoming neighborhoods there. Lebanon, very difficult to get to, and there's a likelihood of being expelled by the Lebanese government. But Christian Iraqis have found that the Christians of Lebanon have been generous in protecting them. Shia Iraqis have tended to go into the Shia neighborhoods of Beirut. Egypt closed its borders more or less after about 150,000 Iraqis came in, mostly Sunni. The majority of the Iraqi Arab refugees are Sunnis, despite the fact that Sunnis are a minority in Iraq. Sweden has taken in, I think, 40, 50,000 as well. They've been quite generous. As you've said, we took in about 700, which is a laughable amount.
What are the politics of this, given that the U.S. said they went into Iraq to save the people of Iraq, only allowing in 700 here?
Well, there are various reasons for why they won't take them in. I think the fact that they're Arab and Muslim is probably one of them. The main factor is probably that if you take in refugees, you're admitting that your whole program in Iraq is a failure. If Iraq is exporting refugees, people are fleeing Iraq for their lives, then everything we've done is a failure, which indeed it is, of course, a failure. And there are also security reasons. Homeland Security Department is finding it difficult to screen the Iraqis, and difficult to even send their people to various embassies to initiate the screening process. So that's taken a painfully long time logistically.
Why can't they screen them?
I think it's just incompetence and sort of a lack of interest. And one of the factors that prevents Iraqis from getting visas, for example, if you've paid a ransom, many Iraqis, virtually every family I know of, have been victims of kidnapping. If you pay a ransom to release your relative from kidnapping, according to the U.S. government, you've materially supported terrorism, and therefore you can be prevented from obtaining a visa to the U.S.
If you've paid any kind of ransom?
Yes.
Governments have paid ransoms, like the Italian government, for people to be released from Iraq.
Yes, I'm sure the U.S. government has as well. But this has been an obstacle for Iraqis. And in general, there's an aversion, it seems, on the part of America to take in Arabs or Muslims, and Iraqis in particular. I think Christians have a much better time. Iraqi Christians is informally the West, whether Australia, England, America, are more likely to take in Christians and are more interested in their plight. I think there's also stronger interest groups in the West, in Canada and the U.S., who are active on behalf of the Iraqi Christians.
What does it do to the politics of a country, to Syria, to Jordan, to Lebanon, having the Iraqi refugees come in? And then I want to broaden that to what is the effect of the war on these countries?
Well, when we think of the Iraqi refugee crisis, we have to think of the crisis that people in the region think of in relation to that one. And that's a Palestinian refugee crisis. In 1948, up to 800,000 Palestinians were expelled from their homes in Palestine to make way for what became Israel. They went to Lebanon, Syria, Jordan. They were put in refugee camps. Eventually, after a few years, they were militarized, mobilized. They had their own militias. They were engaged in attacks, trying to liberate their homes. And they eventually were instrumentalized by the various governments, whether Lebanon, Syria, Jordan. The different groups used them. And they were massacred as well by the Lebanese, by the Jordanians. They contributed to destabilization of Jordan, of Lebanon as well. And I think you will see something similar happening with the Iraqis, because we have much larger numbers, approaching 3 million, and many of them already have links with militias back home, of course, because to survive in Iraq, you need some militia to protect you. And there are long-established smuggling routes for weapons, for fighters, etc. And add to that the very sensitive sectarian issue in Syria, in Jordan. The Syrian regime is a minority regime, perceived by radical Sunnis to be a heretical. Syria is a majority Sunni country. Majority of those refugees are Sunni, but Syria has a good relationship with the Shia-dominated Iraqi government. There have been various Islamist opposition groups who've sought to overthrow their government in Syria. Jordan as well has its own Islamist opposition. We're likely eventually to see, as Sunnis are pushed more and more out of Baghdad, and as the militias are pushed into the Anbar province, that they might link up with Islamist groups in Syria, in Jordan, in Lebanon. So I think it's wrong to think of Iraq as its own conflict. There's now a regional conflict. It's going to involve Syria, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon. And I think we'll see governments being overthrown, for example, the one in Jordan. What we already see are fighters being exported, for example, the fighting in Lebanon the past few months. Many Iraq veterans have sought shelter in Lebanon, in the Palestinian refugee camps, for example.
Talk about that. What's happening right now in Lebanon with Fatah al-Islam, with, in particular, the Nahr al-Bared refugee camp?
Well, Nahr Bar refugee camp doesn't exist anymore. It's been wiped out completely. The Lebanese army destroyed, flattened completely a refugee camp that had once housed 40,000 people, and they've now been made homeless. They left with only the shirts on their backs, basically. What provoked this conflict was the existence of a group called Fatah al-Islam that declared itself in late 2006. They sort of piggybacked onto a pre-existing Palestinian group, a secular one, called Fatah Intifada, taking advantage of, I think, benign neglect on the part of Syria and a very welcoming environment in northern Lebanon, where you have Salafis already who are in close alliance with the Sunni-dominated future movement. And it seems like, as Sy Hirsch explained in his article, the future movement led by Saad Hariri hoped that they could take advantage of the presence of these Salafis and jihadists in the camps and elsewhere to be the sort of the Sunni militia against Hezbollah. But these groups weren't interested in fighting Shias. They were more interested in fighting Israel, the U.S., the Crusaders, and establishing their own sort of Islamic emirate in the north. And as a result, there's been a very brutal and bloody clash with the Lebanese army and security forces. They took advantage of the fact that the Palestinian camps in Lebanon are basically autonomous in terms of security. The Lebanese security forces weren't allowed, thanks to an agreement several decades ago, to actually enter the camps. And some of these camps, Ain Hilwa, south of Beirut, have long been exporting jihadists to Iraq. What happened about a year ago was that the flow was reversed, and fighters from Iraq began seeking shelter elsewhere. They can't go to Jordan, they can't go to Syria. Lebanon was a much more permissive environment, no strong state, no strong security forces. Palestinian camps already sort of lawless, and a place where Lebanese seek shelter if they're absconding from the law, and a very friendly environment for Salafis in the Sunni areas because of the increased sectarian tensions in Lebanon. People in Lebanon are viewing their conflict, especially Sunnis, within the context of the Iraq conflict. They believe in these conspiracy theories about the Shia Crescent, about Shia program, that Iran is exporting its revolution in the region. And these are baseless sort of fears, but they're very strong fears held on the part of Sunnis. And as a result, the Sunnis of Lebanon have been looking for their own militia to protect them from what they believe Hezbollah's attempts to control the country.
What about the comments of Seymour Hersh, the investigation that he did specifically, saying that U.S. and Saudi governments are covertly backing militant Sunni groups like Fatah al-Islam as part of an overarching foreign policy to go after Iran and the Shia influence?
Well, Sy Hirsch and I deal with sort of different levels in the sense that most of my work was on the ground in refugee camps and in poor neighborhoods of Lebanon. So I dealt with the actual militias, not on the geopolitical level with the people who might be sponsoring them. So I found no evidence that the U.S. government or Saudi Arabia were directly involved. What is clear, however, is that jihadist groups in Lebanon are being sponsored and assisted by various Salafis in Lebanon who are very close with the Lebanese government and who support the March 14 movement. And money is coming in certainly from Saudi Arabia, from rich patrons. They are very well armed, very new weapons compared to the Lebanese army, laptops, very well fed. And some of their apartments are rented by people who are closely associated with the Lebanese government. But given where I was, there's no direct U.S. involvement as far as I can see. It would be very foolish for the U.S. to support these jihadists. I think the Lebanese government and its allies found that it was also very dangerous for them, that they cannot control these people and use them for their own ends. We tried this ourselves in Afghanistan and are still suffering from as a result of that. And these groups in Lebanon, I think, actually ended up taking advantage of the Lebanese authorities instead of the other way around.
We're talking to Nir Rosen, independent journalist, author of In the Belly of the Green Bird, The Triumph of the Martyrs in Iraq. He's just come out of Lebanon, has been looking at refugees, the mass crisis. I mean, you're putting the numbers now at, well, over 5 million with those refugees inside Iraq, the internally displaced, around 2 million, and then you're saying 3 million outside.
I think almost 3 million inside. I mean, the rate is increasing so fast every day. Every month, 30 to 50,000 leaving their homes.
Where does the UN come into this and refugee camps in these countries?
Well, until now, there haven't really been refugee camps outside of Iraq. Iraqis have sort of blended into the urban environments of Amman, Jordan, Damascus, Syria, Beirut, Cairo. These are urban people who have fled, and they prefer an urban environment. There's a taboo about refugee camps, and the governments have not set up refugee camps either. So this makes it harder to help them and harder to track them as well. Within Iraq, there have been some camps set up for the internally displaced in southern Iraq. But about 150,000 to 200,000 Iraqis have fled to northern Iraq, Erbil, Sulaymaniyah, Dohuk, and they've also just rented homes in urban areas, in towns. The UN was very slow to respond, in part because of a lack of funding, in part because the UN was still in a sort of intellectual mode where they were assisting the Iraqi government. It was a reconstruction effort, a stability effort, development, not dealing with the humanitarian crisis, because usually it's the other way around. You solve the refugee crisis first, and then you initiate the reconstruction, development, etc. Iraq was unusual in that sense, in that what initially was a reconstruction effort became a humanitarian crisis. And the UN was reluctant to admit it that there was a humanitarian crisis, because that would imply the Iraqi government, which is assisting, is a failure. And in fact, the Iraqi government is a party in the conflict and is one of the main actors in prolonging this conflict, to the extent that we can even say that there is an Iraqi government. So the UN has been very late, in part because it depends on funders. You can't blame the UN. The UN is basically America and the donor countries. But there was this lazy intellectual process of recognizing that Iraq is a failure. And of course, the UN was traumatized by first the failure to prevent the war in Iraq. And so it's been seeking a mission ever since then. And of course, the bombing in August 2003, which basically expelled the UN from Iraq.
What do you make of the Syrian Prime Minister Monday saying that his country will help rebuild Iraq, help Iraqis rebuild Iraq?
Well, I think it's optimistic. I don't think anybody can really help Iraq at this point. And Syria lacks the funds. We in the West have been focused too much on Iran and Syria as if they are the solution to Iraq, or the problem, or the cause of the problem, whereas, in fact, this is mainly an internal conflict. And there isn't much that a country like Syria can do. The U.S., with all of its troops and all of its money, has failed completely. Syria does have the advantage of having a good relationship with all the parties in the conflict. It's been very good at maintaining relations with Sunni resistance groups, with Shia radicals like Muqtada Sadr. Maliki, the prime minister, actually lived in Syria for a long time. President Talabani was in exile in Syria when he established his own political party, the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan. So Syria does have a very good relationship, and it could be the key to bringing some of the Iraqi groups together. But at this point, I think there's actually no hope.
Nir, what about Iran? What about the whole Bush-Cheney push to attack Iran? And what is the significance of this, and how does it play out in these countries?
Well, I think we're dealing with a mentality on the part of our administration that nobody else is going to have the guts to take on Iran in the future, the next president. So if we don't do it, who's going to do it? And we'll be vindicated in the future, just like Reagan was vindicated, allegedly, for bringing down the Soviet Union. So they have this long-term view of how history will treat them. And if they don't take down Iran, nobody else will, which is probably the case. Although they can't take down Iran either. Iran is not Iraq. You can bomb it, but I think you only basically strengthen the support for the government, as always happens when you bomb a country. We saw this in Yugoslavia and elsewhere. And they've been blaming Iran for everything under the sun lately, for supporting Sunni radicals in Iraq who are attacking the Iranian-backed leadership in Iraq, and then they blame Iran for supporting the Taliban, who, of course, were bitter enemies of Iran. So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
And interestingly, the president of Afghanistan, Karzai, coming and saying Iran is a partner, and then receiving Ahmadinejad in Afghanistan, and President Bush at the same time attacking Iran.
Well, the countries in the region know that they can't lose Iran as an ally and as a neighbor. The U.S. can easily alienate Iran without suffering too many consequences. But Iraq does depend on Iran as a friendly neighbor, likewise Afghanistan. And if you were to antagonize Iran, of course, the consequences would be much more severe than antagonizing Iraq, which had a very weak army.
What are the politics? Why is Bush doing this?
Well, there is a general aversion on the part of the U.S. administration towards any Islamist movement or government. This is why they brought down the Islamic course in Somalia. This is why they overthrew the Hamas democratically elected government in Palestine. This is why they refused to deal with Hezbollah, an overwhelmingly popular movement in Lebanon. I think, a fear of any successful Islamist model. And we've had a long animosity with Iran. We haven't forgiven them, I think, for the hostage crisis a few decades ago. And I think we're now in search of a new enemy. When I wrote my book, I was doing research in LexisNexis, and I found that in May 2003, universally, the U.S. press was talking about, when do we go to war against Iran? Iraq has been such a success. We brought down Saddam's regime so quickly. So now Iran is next, obviously. And everybody was behind us, of course.
The Lieberman-sponsored resolution condemning Iranians fighting in Iraq for killing U.S. soldiers. But then the report coming out that there are more Saudi fighters in Iraq than Iranian fighters.
It's difficult for me to understand why the Shias would need Iranian fighters. Iraqis are very good at killing, as we've seen. Shias were in the army. They were the majority of the army. Shias were in the Fedayeen, Saddam as well. And they've been very eager to fight the Americans, the Mahdi army, other groups. So Iran might be sponsoring various Shia militias, of course. It has its own proxies in Iraq. It's the Supreme Council, one of our main allies. The Dawa Party, one of our main allies. The Sadr movement, to a lesser extent. And, of course, some of the Kurdish parties as well. Iran has a very good relationship with various Iraqi movements. I'm skeptical that they're actually sending fighters to Iraq. I just don't see the need for it. Iraqis are very well trained. They might be sending some weapons. But then again, there's also a black market in weapons. So just because a weapon is Iranian doesn't mean that it's necessarily been sold by the Iranian government. Various groups use American weapons. It doesn't mean that the Americans are arming people. Although, in fact, we are arming militias. I mean, it's very hypocritical for the U.S. to complain about any foreign intervention in Iraq in the first place, given that we occupied Iraq and destroyed it. And now we're arming Sunni militias in various neighborhoods, making the situation much worse. In various Sunni neighborhoods of Baghdad, we're creating our own militias. We are the ones who armed the police and the army, who are, in effect, controlled by a sectarian Shia militia. So it's absurd to take the American accusations seriously, except that they are intending to go to war against Iran.
On that issue, Nir Rosen, Time magazine ran an article this week called Prelude to an Attack on Iran. It ends with a quote from an unnamed U.S. official, "There will be an attack on Iran," he said.
I mean, this is just such a foolish game to play. American soldiers are basically held hostage in Iraq. They can't leave and they can't stay. And Iran has the ability to make things much more difficult for the Americans. Until now, while we are fighting Shia militias, Shia resistance groups, it's not a sort of universal uprising on the part of Shias. We did face that a little bit in 2004, and it was very difficult for the Americans. But Iran does have the ability to mobilize Iraqi Shias, of course, against the Americans. And if it wanted to sponsor other groups who might want to fight the Americans. Iran, until now, I think, has been the primary beneficiary of the U.S. war in Iraq, in that their people are the ones in charge. And their main enemy, or one of them after Israel, Saddam Hussein, was removed. So we could have seen Iran as an ally in all this. And I think that we could have seen them as an ally in Afghanistan as well. But we've chosen to invent an enemy where we didn't have one before.
David Petraeus, the general, this report that's coming out along with the Ambassador Crocker, it's second week of September, it's now reported, they may well be reporting on September 11th to Congress. What is the significance of this?
I don't think it's significant. What can they say that would make any impact one way or the other?
What do you think has to happen?
In Iraq? It's too late for anything good to happen in Iraq, unfortunately. If the Americans stay, we'll see a continuation of this civil war of ethnic cleansing until all of Iraq is sort of ethnically or sectarian homogenous zones, which is basically what's already happened. If the Americans leave, then you'll see greater intervention of Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, supporting their own militias in Iraq and being drawn into the battle. But no matter what, Iraq doesn't exist anymore. Baghdad will never be in the hands of Sunnis again. Baghdad will be controlled by Shia militias. They've been cleansing all the Sunnis from Baghdad. Sunnis are basically being pushed out of Iraq, period. They can go to the Anbar province, which isn't a very friendly place. I think you'll see that there won't be any more elections in Iraq. Maliki is the last prime minister that Iraq will have for a long time. There's neither the infrastructure for elections anymore, nor the desire to have them, nor the ability of Iraqi groups to cooperate anymore. So what you'll see is basically Mogadishu in Iraq, various warlords controlling small neighborhoods. And those who are by major resources, such as oil installations, obviously will be foreign-sponsored warlords who will be able to cut deals with us, the Chinese. But Iraq is destroyed, and I think we'll see that this will spread throughout the region, and this will destabilize Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan as well.
Before we wrap up, I want to talk about the occupied territories, about Gaza and the West Bank, particularly Gaza. Now the news out, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in Gaza enduring a fifth day of power blackouts. The outages began after the European Union suspended its funding of Gaza's main electricity plant. What's happening now?
Well, Hamas was elected democratically in elections at the U.S. and President Jimmy Carter. And the international community recognized we're free and fair. We, of course, were very upset that Hamas won the elections, and we imposed sanctions on them and tried to overthrow the government in a soft coup by basically strangling the economy. And that didn't work. As a result, we increased the heat on Hamas. We began training and sponsoring Fatah militias with the cooperation of Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and, of course, Israel, and attempted to overthrow the Hamas democratically elected government. And that, too, failed. And Hamas actually managed to eject the Fatah militias from Gaza. And of course, now thanks to U.S. pressure, the Europeans, who would like to deal with Hamas, who have a much more realistic view of the Middle East, are unable to do so. And I mean, all you're doing is actually radicalizing this group. This is one of the more moderate group, Islamist groups in the region, in fact. And they were willing to negotiate with Israel. But what you do when you allow a group like this to be to take part in elections, and then when they win, you try to overthrow them, is merely radicalize them and encourage the Salafis, those with leanings towards Al-Qaeda.
Explain what you mean by Salafis.
Salafis, like the Wahhabis of Saudi Arabia, a much stricter interpretation of Islam. Generally, they reject any innovations and any form of modernity, any deviations from what they perceive as a true Islam, whether Shiism or influences of modernity, of reform. They often as well believe that if you don't follow their line of thinking, you're a heretic, you're an infidel, and you can be killed. Zarqawi was a Salafi, for example. Now, these movements are not very strong in Palestine yet. But what we're doing is taking a moderate group like Hamas and actually encouraging it to be more radical, telling them that negotiations, politics, elections won't work. All you have is violence. It's such a foolish process, because you can't push them into the sea, which is what Israel would like to do, of course. But if you keep them in this prison, which is Gaza, and you bomb them every day, which is what Israel is doing, and they've killed, since Israel withdrew from Gaza, they've killed over 150 children and hundreds of civilians. So it's not exactly a withdrawal in the first place.
What do you think needs to happen there?
What needs to happen at this point is a one-state solution, where Palestinian refugees are allowed to go back to their homes, where Israel is a state for Jews and non-Jews alike, state for its citizens. And this one-state solution is inevitable. I think the choice that Israeli Jews have is whether they accept it peacefully, following the model in South Africa, or do they wait a few decades and have to deal with a much more violent uprising on the part of the Arab Israeli population and the population in the West Bank and Gaza. But I think one way or the other, it's inevitable. Israel can't exist as a Jewish state that doesn't give equal rights to its non-Jewish Arab citizens.
Nir Rosen, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Nir Rosen, independent journalist. His book is called In the Belly of the Green Bird, The Triumph of the Martyrs in Iraq. He is just back from Beirut, Lebanon. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we talk to two teenagers who are walking across the country for peace. Stay with us.
Been happy lately, thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world at one, and I believe it could be someday it's going to come. 'Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a peace train. Oh, peace train, take this country, come take me home again. Yeah, I've been smiling lately, thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, peace train sounding louder, ride on the peace train.
Train by Cat Stevens or Yusuf Islam. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Ashley Cassell and Michael Israel are two determined teenagers who chose to spend their summer walking from San Francisco to Washington, D.C. to protest the war. Ashley will be a sophomore this fall at Wesleyan University. She came up with the idea of a cross-country march and set up a website to invite more people to join her. The only person who stuck it out was Michael Israel, an 18-year-old just out of high school. Michael joined Ashley after reading about her project on the internet. They have been walking since San Francisco. They began their journey 3 months ago. I spoke to Ashley and Michael last week when they were in Indianapolis, and I began by asking Ashley to describe why she decided to embark on this 3,000-mile walk.
Our march is for nonviolence in general. We're advocating for nonviolent global solutions, and so that's peace in every sense of the word. The ideals behind our march are sort of broad. One is about the war in Iraq, that we want to urge the U.S. government to end the war. And another, we want to raise awareness about genocide in Darfur. We want to advocate increased environmental sustainability and social justice, economic justice, and all things that we believe relate to peace. And as we've crossed the country, I contacted a lot of peace organizations before we even left who were planning demonstrations and rallies for us. A lot of them have been geared towards the war in Iraq, which is a really pressing issue right now, we realize. So we've been joining rallies and demonstrations as we cross the country.
You just came from Colorado. Did you have problems walking in a park there?
Yeah, there was an incident in the Rocky Mountain National Park. Our track took us through Route 34 that goes straight through the park, and we wanted to walk through there. There were just two of us, Mike and I, at the time, and we had our signs, which are basically like bibs that just cover the front of our shirts, and they say March for Peace, San Francisco to D.C. And they stopped us at the entrance gate, and where we were trying to just pay the fee and walk through, and they didn't want us to walk through. They said that the signs were too political and that we would need to get a permit. We felt that they weren't really signs. We weren't holding them. We weren't going to stop anywhere and demonstrate. And the purpose was just like a T-shirt to say what we were doing. And we didn't think it would be right to take them off. But they gave us kind of a hassle there. We ended up taking off the signs but writing the same message on our T-shirts because we feel like it's really important to let people know what we're doing as we cross the country.
The same thing, something happened to you along the Golden Gate Bridge as you tried to walk across it?
That was a different situation. We had our banner with us, which is a pretty large banner that says March for Peace, San Francisco to D.C., and we were stopped on the Golden Gate Bridge because they said it was obstructing traffic, and the officer said that we might be causing an accident if, you know, someone saw the banner and got distracted. So we understood that because it was a huge banner, but the signs in the national park were much smaller and just on our body, like taking up as much space as a T-shirt, and so we felt like there was a different reason that they were telling us we couldn't go through, and it was more of their political agenda.
Are you planning to legally challenge that, not being allowed to walk in Rocky Mountain Park with a T-shirt, a bib on your T-shirt that said March for Peace?
We're actually not planning to legally challenge it. It got a lot of coverage in the Denver Post and other newspapers around there, and we received some calls from lawyers who wanted us to pursue it. But it was something we talked about a lot, and what we decided was the only way we'd be willing to pursue it is if we really felt that it would set a precedent and help activists in the future and really get the message out, and it wasn't quite clear to us that that would actually be the case, so we decided not to pursue it. We don't just want to, you know, vindicate ourselves or anything. We would only pursue a case if we felt that it would have real significance to the peace movement in general.
We're talking to Ashley Cassell and Michael Israel, who are walking across the country from San Francisco to New York, Washington, D.C., actually. Michael, what stands out for you most so far now that I speak to you in Indianapolis?
What stands out the most as far as
your experiences? Your experiences, what you remember most, a moment, a gathering, a person that you met?
Well, we've been through a lot of places and met a lot of really amazing people. So, I mean, there's a number of things that stand out. I think a lot about when we were going through Nevada and parts of Utah where it was just nothing for it was just desert for miles and miles. I think about that and just how, it was really hard, but it was also kind of funny at times, just how there are some people out of Carson City that thought they could help us out through the desert and bring us water or food, but it ended up that they had other things they needed to do or didn't have time, so they would end up like dropping out on us. And there's also just places I remember in Colorado where we would be in the newspapers like the day before we walk into a town, and as we're walking in, we find out just like this one little town in the middle of Colorado has there's a surprising amount of people that want to come out and support us. I mean, in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, there was a time where we couldn't walk for 5 minutes without someone stopping in their car and jumping out and bringing us water or offering us a place to sleep at night. And just all along the way, we've met a lot of amazing people and seen a lot of really great things.
Ashley, is it mainly young people or older people who are joining you along the way? And are you hoping that there will be more people marching along with you as you make your way to Washington?
Yeah, we've gained more marchers now. There's 7 of us all together. One's a support vehicle driver, and we always encourage more to walk with us. People can also walk with us for just a day. Our website, marchforpeace.info, is updated a couple times a day, and it says right where we are, and they can come out and join us anytime. And in terms of the age of people, it has been mainly older people who have been our supporters, people who are in their 50s and 60s from the Vietnam era. But we have had some younger people. And I think that's our hope, both Mike and I, is that more and more young people will come out and that we can try to start a movement among our age group, because we feel like that's really, we're the future, and it depends on us to make a change happen. So if we can get more young people to come out with us and stand up for peace, then that's going to make the most difference in the future.
When do you plan to arrive in Washington?
We're going to arrive there on September 10th, and we're going to be walking in from Arlington, Virginia on September 10th. It's a Monday. And that night, we're going to be encamping Washington without a permit. We're going to be trying to rally a couple hundred people, maybe, to set up tents with us out there, and risking arrest, obviously. But we feel like that's a really important thing for us to do, and to take a risk now that maybe hasn't been taken before. And we're going to be staying in Washington through the week, through to Saturday, when Answer Coalition is having a big rally there that should call people from all over the country.
Ashley Cassell and Michael Israel, 2 teenagers walking across the country, will arrive in Washington, D.C. on September 10th. Their website, marchforpeace.info. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Hoda Kadus, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Maté, Anjali Kamet, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Carrie Mache, Mike DeFilippo, and Miguel Nogueira are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Hugh Grand, John Randolph, Jerome Bourgeois, Kieran Krug-Meadows, Samantha Chamblay. Our website is democracynow.org. You can get our headlines there in Spanish. You can get the headlines and every transcript of the broadcast, as well as our video and audio podcast. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Thanks so much for joining us.